This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the New Books Network podcast in Asian American Studies. I'm your host, Donna Doan Anderson, and joining me in conversation today is my colleague and friend, Tandy Wong.
Hi, everyone.
Today, we have the privilege of interviewing Dr. Wendy Chang, professor of American Studies at Scripps College and a core faculty member of the Intercollegiate Department of Asian American Studies.
We have the pleasure of discussing Chang's latest book, Island X, Taiwanese Student Migrants, Campus Spies, and Cold War Activism, which was published by the University of Washington Press in November 2023. Island X delves into the compelling political lives of Taiwanese migrants who came to the US as students from the 1960s through to the 1980s. Often depicted as compliant model minorities, many were deeply political, shaped by Taiwan's colonial history, and influenced by the global social movements of their times. As activists, they fought to make Taiwanese people visible as subjects of injustice and deserving of self-determination.
Under the distorting shadows of Cold War geopolitics, the Kuomintang regime and collaborators across U.S. campuses attempted to control Taiwanese in the diaspora through extra-legal surveillance and violence, including harassment, blacklisting, imprisonment, and even murder. Drawing on interviews with student activists and extensive archival research, Wendy Chang documents how Taiwanese Americans developed tight-knit social networks as infrastructures for identity formation, consciousness development, and anti-colonial activism. They fought for Taiwanese independence, opposed state persecution and oppression, and participated in global political movements. Raising questions about historical memory and Cold War circuits of power, Island X is a testament to the lives and advocacy of a generation of Taiwanese American activists.
In addition to Island X, Wendy Chang is also the author of The Changs Next Door to the Diazes, Remapping Race in Suburban California, and co-author of A People's Guide to Los Angeles. Her articles and creative nonfiction writing have been published in The American Quarterly, Amerasia Journal, Los Angeles Review of Books, and New Bloom, among others. You can find more information at wendychang.com.
Hi, Wendy. Thank you so much for joining us in conversation today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so to get us started, would you tell us a little bit more about how you came to this topic and what inspired you to write this book?
Yeah, so this topic was a long time coming. I was actually born into it because it's my family history. My parents were graduate students who came to the U.S. from Taiwan in the early 1970s. So they were part of that generation of student migrants, many of whom became activists, that I write about in this book. And I realized at some point in the process of writing the book that this history is actually how we became Taiwanese American ourselves, because my parents, like many of the people I write about in the book, they went to University of Wisconsin-Madison. They encountered a lot of other Taiwanese students there, or students from Taiwan who identified in different ways. and they became involved in student associations there, and then soon became aware that they were being surveilled, and for taking a leadership position in one of those organizations, my father was blacklisted. And so they actually never had the intention of staying in the US, but because they got involved in these organizations, they ended up not being able to go back to Taiwan, right? And this is the story for many Taiwanese of that generation, but it's very little known outside of Taiwanese American communities. And not even, I wouldn't even say that everybody in different kinds of Taiwanese American communities is aware of this history for various reasons. But because once they were blacklisted, they felt they had nothing to lose, right? So like many others of their generation, they just threw themselves even more so into organizing for democracy, human rights, you know, for a different kind of future for Taiwan, for the end of martial law. And those were the circles that I grew up in. But then the second part of that is, even though this was very much my childhood and a shared experience within the Taiwanese American communities that I grew up in, when I went to graduate school and started doing scholarship in ethnic studies and Asian American studies, there was no, there was nothing about these histories. There was literature on Taiwanese migration, right? But it didn't really talk about politics. Taiwan itself, at least at the time that I started researching this book, which was 12 years ago, took a long time for reasons we can get into later. There was almost nothing of a critical history of Taiwanese Americans within the field itself. So that really interested me too. So it got me thinking about, you know, why is that, you know, and, you know, what is it about the field and its particular orientations that makes that history not recognized or not legible? And what do I want to do with that, right? So it was this mix of my own family history and the communities that I grew up with, and putting that side by side with the relative absence of those histories in Asian American studies, in general consciousness, right? And so on. So that was the starting point.
I love the personal connection that you have with the book and how it moves from a research project that has these questions that are embedded in your own life, and then deals with this larger question about various fields of study and this kind of historiographical gap that you're identifying, in which we don't hear very much about Taiwanese migration in general, especially student migration, and all of the different forces that structure fields of knowledge such that we have that gap. You actually write in the text that Taiwan is often regarded as an insignificant place, yet its marginal and ambiguous status offers many entry points for understanding relationships of power and subject formation beyond a nation-state framework. That's a quote from page 10. And so I'm wondering, for listeners who are unfamiliar with Taiwan, could you provide some elaboration on what its ambiguous status is? And in particular, what is the difference between Bensengren and Waisengren, and how does it figure in Taiwan's liminal geopolitical position?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And in the quote that you read, I'm building from Xu Meishi's important work, right, where she has done so much to try to place Taiwan in critical theory, to think about Taiwan as a place where what she and Binghui Liao call layered and serial colonialism, and also think critically about its relationship to the U.S. So I would say her work has been really important as a jumping off point for me. So the ambiguous status, it's been much more in the news lately. But it's still, I mean, it's very interesting because most scholars from the US and Europe who have studied Taiwan either come from political science, well, largely come from political science, right? So they're thinking about Taiwan as triangulated between the US and China. And so that is a basis of its ambiguous status today because the official U.S. policy toward Taiwan is described as strategic ambiguity, right? Which means that the U.S. Neither supports Taiwan independence, nor does it support Taiwan's unification or reunification, right? Both of those terms are loaded with China. But this comes directly from a Cold War history where so much of the world immediately after World War II was divided into communist and anti-communist positions, right? So the KMT, the Kuomintang, or Nationalist Party, lost the civil war in China to the Chinese communists, fled to Taiwan, and set up a government there, claiming to be the one true government of China, right? And the U.S. supported them, right, through military aid, diplomatic recognition, economic aid, you know, all kinds of forms of support. But what happened is that this created a new era for Taiwan, which was coming out of Japanese colonial rule, right? And so you asked about Bun Shengren and Wei Shengren. So Bun Shengren refers to so-called local or self-identified native but not indigenous Taiwanese, right, whose ancestors came mostly from southeastern China during the Qing period, right, from the 1600s to the 1800s. And during that time, Taiwan had a very liminal position in relationship to Qing-ruled China, right? It was seen as Emma Tang describes it, right, as a ball of mud, right? This kind of undesirable backwater that was kind of very loosely attached to the Qing Empire, right? So people who are known as Bun Shengren ancestors come from that time period and lived under Qing rule, this liminal Qing rule, and then under the Japanese colonial period, and then under nationalist rule. So Wei Shengren, which means people from outside province, right, refers to what is often translated as mainlanders, right, people who came with the nationalists when they fled to Taiwan after losing the Chinese Civil War, and ended up constituting about 20% of the population, right? But came right into the ruling structure that the Japanese had been forced to abandon when they lost the war. So this created a new kind of intra-ethnic hierarchy that then became ethnicized in Taiwan. So that is a slice of a complicated history, but that triangulated relationship between the U.S. and China has persisted, with the U.S. acting as a hedge between Taiwan and claims to Taiwan by the PRC, right, between the rest of the world, but maintaining it purposely in this ambiguous or liminal position.
Yeah, so I'm thinking a lot about what you're saying, Wendy, and particularly these words surrounding liminality and triangulation, and how there are some very obvious parallels to Asian American studies scholarship in these terms, right? To think about what our positionality is, not only kind of on a global or diplomatic scale, but also how that impacts the interpersonal, right? And so one of the things that, you know, we have been talking about in Asian American studies is that Asian American studies is usually seeing its activists as those who articulated an internationalist racial consciousness formed in opposition to US racism and overseas imperialism. So quintessential examples of this are, for example, the Third World Liberation Front that created ethnic studies in the US, the campaign to save the Ibe Hotel in San Francisco, or civil rights activists like Yuri Kochiyama. So when we're talking in your book about Taiwanese independence activists on US campuses, they don't necessarily fit into this framework. Not only was their critique directed towards Taiwan, but as you note, quote, most Taiwanese student migrants did not develop a sustained critique of the United States itself. And that is from page 46. Yet the student activists you investigate in this book were radicalized by the same campus environments that shaped quintessential Asian American protests, especially anti-Vietnam War protests. So how do you make sense of this disjuncture between Taiwanese student activism and Asian American activism?
Great. Yeah, thank you. That's such an important question for me personally, intellectually, politically, and it really shapes one of the central questions of the book, because Asian American politics of the type that you're describing are ones that I very much identify with, right, and believe in as part of a necessary intervention into different kinds of global hegemony. However, at the same time, I think that Asian American studies, at least as it has evolved over time, if not in its origins, has to guard a bit more conscientiously against US centrism in knowledge formation, in political formation, and so on. And what that means is not judging the political consciousness formation of different groups by the same measures. And so Taiwanese student migrants, or let's say student migrants from Taiwan, some of them identified as Taiwanese, some of them did not during this time period. They were coming out of a country that was ruled by martial law, right? They were coming out of a transition from Japanese colonial rule into nationalist authoritarian rule. And so the immediate goal for many of them was, how do we topple the KMT, right? How do we end martial law? How do we act effectively against this authoritarian government? And so many of them came into their political goals with that immediate and urgent goal in mind. And so everything that they were reading and doing sometimes made for strange alliances, right? Because they could share that goal, but not necessarily agree on what they thought about, how they felt about socialism or how they felt about capitalism, right? So there are alliances of individuals who have very different politics, but share that goal during this time period on US campuses. And I think that's a really important thing to, a really important context to bring to understanding the Taiwanese migrant politics or Taiwanese political consciousness formation in the US. I think that the question of the US, the critique of the US, has to do with a lot of different things. One is that this generation of student migrants came under the conditions that Madeline Hsu has described really well in her book, right, of selective migration. Most of them were graduate students in STEM fields, right, from the 60s to the 80s. And so that is not, that doesn't have a simple trajectory, because in Taiwan, the very best students of those generations were generally channeled into STEM fields, right? And they didn't necessarily see that as apolitical or non-political, right? They saw that as a natural background for people who would become leaders of Taiwanese society in one way or another, right? So it wasn't necessarily that those fields were not political, but that in their selective migration to the United States, they became part of an upward class status, right? Even if they came from working class backgrounds, they experienced upward mobility coming into the US. And then in the US, because of language barriers, cultural barriers, and so on, right? They were not necessarily connected to people with other kinds of class backgrounds in the ways they might have been if they had stayed in Taiwan, right? So there's a kind of class selectivity that starts to happen. And then also, again, that martial law authoritarian context is really important, because they did, to some extent, experience significantly more freedom in the US than they had experienced growing up under authoritarian rule in Taiwan, right? And this meant something to them. So interestingly, my father, right? So the first people I interviewed for this book were my parents. And I should also say that I had to, this is not at all a straightforward representation of my family history and what I understood of those politics. I had to do a lot of unlearning of those politics too. But I don't know why it happened this way, but my parents did end up being some very significant interviews for me. And so the way my dad put it is that Taiwanese student migrants came into what he described as a contradictory but fantastic set of circumstances in the US, right? So fantastic in that sense of, you know, so my father described coming to University of Wisconsin in the early 1970s and seeing Vietnamese students coming from Vietnam who were critical of the US, right? And this is another example of that, that people's consciousnesses are not determined by the circumstances through which they come to the US, right? And so he encountered these Vietnamese students who were critical of the US, and he was just totally floored by that, right? As this fantastic thing. But then it was contradictory, right? Because the US was the same entity, the US state was the same entity that was giving them the opportunity to come to the US, experience these greater freedoms, experience greater safety in life, experience access to the materials that could form their critique, and so on. But I don't think, so I think they were able to come into a wide sphere of politics that were based on Chinese language circles, right? So they were interacting with students coming from Hong Kong, they were interacting with some Chinese Americans. So in that sense, it was very global, but they weren't always able to make connections to or be reached out to by non-Chinese speaking groups, right? And this is also because Taiwan as Republic of China was seen as an ally of the US, right? So they didn't have the same kind of cachet, that issue of legibility, right? They might be interested in other groups, but those other groups weren't reaching out to them.
Your book does such a great job of grounding us in the specificity of the Taiwanese student migrant context. I think it's just so important, exactly as you outlined, to understand where these students are coming from and how they encountered the US and what exactly it was that they were creating political alliances and coalitions to change. In chapter one of your book, you use the heuristic of infrastructures of activism and surveillance to help explicate some of these contexts, which you use as a term to refer to networks of students and spies that enabled and restricted political activism in different ways. Can you explain for our listeners some of these infrastructures? What was it like for Taiwanese students arriving on US campuses, and why was so much activism happening on Midwestern campuses especially?
Thank you for that question. So one thing that selective educational migration created unintentionally was a very strong, already established set of relationships among student migrants who were coming from Taiwan during this time period. And so this had to do with the educational system in Taiwan, which tracked the highest scoring students with each other, right? Starting from junior high and into high school. And then once you applied for a specific department, right, you had to score a certain score to get into that department. And then you would be placed within, whatever, say, like some of the top scoring students would be in chemical engineering or physics, right, at National Taiwan University, and so on. And so the result of this is that some of the students that ended up on US campuses in these STEM departments had known each other since childhood, right? Or junior high. And also Taiwan was not a big place, right? So if they didn't know each other directly, sometimes it's a matter of one or two degrees of separation, right? And so they felt like they had a sense of where they were coming from, right? A lot of them could remember each other from younger versions of themselves. They knew each other's families, right? And so this made it easy for them to create a sense of trust and shared context when they were arriving on those campuses, you know. But again, like I said, they were really great at organizing. And so they didn't even have to know each other directly. They would arrive on the campuses and make directories of students from Taiwan. And then as soon as a new person arrived, somebody would go pick them up, right? And maybe they would be 1 or 2 degrees separated, right? And they would immediately be enfolded within this student association structure, which was a bit more complicated because there were 2 to 3 different student associations, right? Which then started to delineate some of the politics, right? Whether students from Taiwan joined the Chinese Student Association, which was broadly pro-KMT, right? And often infiltrated by KMT agents, or the Taiwanese Student Associations, which identified as Taiwanese, right? And were very much on the radar of the KMT as subversive, right? And then sometimes there was a third student organization that was pro-communist, right? And interested in the PRC and so on. So because of these tight networks that were established by the educational system and by selective migration, they were able to organize themselves really easily and also have a basis of trust for often very risky interactions like smuggling information or radio equipment or declarations of, you know, Taiwanese rights and human independence, right, through these shared circles. So that was part of it. And then the reason why it ended up, so much of this happened on the Midwest. So hotspots for Taiwanese student activism, University of Wisconsin, right? Kansas State University was another big one, also had to do with these distinctions between Ben Shengren and Wei Shengren, because Ben Shengren tended to be more working class, lower middle class during this time period. And Wei Shengren, while not uniformly, the Wei Shengren who were coming to the US, many more of them tended to have more elite family backgrounds. And so they might be able to go to a more prestigious universities, right? Columbia, right? On the East Coast or in California. The students who were coming to the Midwest were often some of these best students, but they were coming to places that were offering them scholarships, TA-ships and RA-ships. They were coming to places that were offering them to pay in-state tuition, right, instead of international student tuition, right? And for some of these students for whom coming to the US was, you know, their family's entire life savings, right? These were really important things. So especially Ben Shengren, native or local Taiwanese students tended to cluster at these big public universities in the Midwest that were offering them more support.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I have many thoughts about the Midwest that perhaps would detract from the conversation's trajectory.
I think it would add to the conversation.
So maybe that could be a separate episode, a conversation around the Midwest and Taiwanese international students. But I guess to kind of think about the next chapter of the book, right? Chapter 2, which outlines the complex political positions taken up by diasporic Taiwanese leftists. So while the mainstream of Taiwanese independence activists saw the People's Republic of China or the leftist ideology and Chineseness as opposed to Taiwaneseness as all incompatible with an independent Taiwan, the activists you examined thought quite differently. Could you outline some of these positions taken up by these activists and how they understood their relationship to the Chinese Communist Party, Taiwan's ruling Kuomintang Party, and leftism in general?
Okay, so this actually relates to the earlier question about prototypical Asian American politics and activism and the place or the politics of Taiwanese students. Because so one of the things that was going on US campuses especially in the 60s and into the 70s, so there's opposition to the war in Vietnam, right? And then there's also massive interest in Maoism and what's happening in the PRC among young people all over the world, right? And so what I found when I started to do this research is that although the Chinese Communist Party and Taiwanese independence activists are seen to be mutually exclusive categories today, right, as part of those hardened binaries of the Cold War, during this time, they were not actually positioned as enemies, you know, especially in the late 1960s and into the late 1970s, because they shared a common enemy, right? And their common enemy during that time was the KMT, the Kuomintang. And so the PRC, the Chinese Communist, represented by the Chinese Communist Party, was very much trying to recruit Taiwan independence activists to their cause, right? So a record that my brother found in my parents' house when they packed up the house and moved away is like a propaganda record, right? That says, you know, like the people of Taiwan are brothers, right? Trying to enfold them within their global politics, right? They were very much making an appeal to the global left, right? And Taiwan, people in Taiwan who were ruled by the authoritarian KMT were very much seen as part of that possible fold, right? And so something that really interested me is that a lot of Taiwan independence activists during that time were also interested in the PRC, right? And so in chapter 5, I talk about the case of Chen Wencheng, who was a young statistics professor at Carnegie Mellon who'd gone to University of Michigan for his PhD. And he was tragically murdered while he was in the custody of the Taiwan Garrison Command on a return trip to Taiwan in 1981. And he's typically understood as a martyr for the cause of Taiwan independence and democracy. But what I found out when I dug into his politics a little more deeply is that he actually was very interested in the PRC and actually dedicated his PhD dissertation to the people of China and to the working class, right? And but this is a narrative and politics that that is too complex, right, for the way that those paths diverged after this time period. But it wasn't uncommon, right? It was a minority, but it wasn't uncommon. Right. So other people I had interviewed similarly were trying to sort out the appeal of socialism, the appeal of communism, the appeal of gender equality, right? And all of these things that Maoism offered, right? And some of them, some students from Taiwan did become supporters of the Chinese Communist Party and the PRC, right? Either only during that time or even still to this day. Right. But those histories are seen as so unsayable, right, or illegible, right, that they're not usually talked about as part of the same history. So what was happening on these campuses, many of them on the Midwest, was that, you know, students would arrive and they'd immediately be caught up in this very vibrant Sinophone, global Sinophone sphere of political learning, right? So they would hit up all the East Asian libraries and read everything they could, right, in Chinese about the PRC, about Taiwanese history, right? Everything that they could get a hold of. And some Taiwanese students even went to visit the PRC, right? And they wrote about their relationships to China versus Taiwan and their politics and so on. So I really wanted to put those histories back together, not necessarily as a way of disrupting, of not necessarily as a way of saying, hey, you know, Taiwan should be part of China, right? Because I don't believe that. but to put Taiwanese back into that sphere of global politics, right? Because I think a lot of the ways the politics has evolved limits Taiwan independence to an ethnic nationalism rather than a kind of politics that was worked out through engagement with global politics, of which Maoism was very important during that time period.
In chapters 3, 4, and 5 of the book, you actually provide us with case studies of specific activists whose life stories reveal some of the dynamics of Taiwanese diasporic activism that you've just discussed throughout the Cold War. And I know you mentioned Chen Wen-chen in chapter 5, but I'm wondering if you could take us through these other figures and what they reveal for you about the larger networks of activism and surveillance that these student migrants were embedded in.
Great. Yeah, thank you for that question. And I want to kind of interject an invitation here, which is that chapters 3, 4, and 5 actually came out of both my abilities and my limitations as an Asian Americanist. Because when I first, so I mentioned at the beginning of the interview that this book took me 12 years to not exactly to write, but to finish, right, from the first interview to when it was finally published. And part of it was because I had to change the shape of the project. So initially, I was really interested in the kind of politics that we just talked about. And one thing I didn't say is that Taiwanese were not just, you know, hanging out in social events and doing certain actions, right? But they're also publishing quite a lot of political material on their own, right? So the National Tsinghua University Library has a collection of over 100 publications, political publications that were created by Taiwanese outside of Taiwan, you know, from the 60s to the 90s, especially, right? And it's such an amazing archive. But most of those publications are in Chinese, which makes sense, right? But also meant that I, as someone who is not fluent in Chinese, could not do justice to the nuances of what they're doing, right? So I had some of them translated, right? And I do refer to them as well as I can, but I was not able to create a whole book out of that, right? So that's an invitation to scholars who do have those skills to do that work, right? Because there are these incredible archives that have not yet been really examined in detail by scholars who have this kind of critical, complete bilingual, bicultural analysis, or multilingual, multicultural could be. So what I did, which worked for me, was to look at specific cases of people, of student migrants who were surveilled while they were in the U.S. by the KMT surveillance apparatus, right? And this is another contradiction of that relationship between the U.S. and Taiwan, because this was done with the knowledge and tacit permission of the United States, right? So this was very like micro surveillance, right? People were being tailed wherever they went, right? Recordings between people in the US and Taiwan were being recorded and transcribed verbatim, right? And you can see a lot of this material in the National Archives in Taiwan. So I looked at specific cases of people who, based on surveillance that happened in the US, were then met with arrest or imprisonment, and in Sun Wen-sung's case, murder in Taiwan because of that permissiveness that the US, the relationship between the US and Taiwan as the Republic of China created, right? That that student migrants in the US were not beyond the reach of the KMT state. And what this also meant was that those archives were much more accessible to me, right? That a lot of the materials were in English. I could really dig into university archives. I could look at, for example, in chapter 4, which looks at Chen Yuxi, the case of Chen Yuxi, which happened out of Hawaii. The Honolulu Advertiser and the other newspapers in Honolulu covered his case in detail, right? Hundreds of newspaper articles, and then also Library of Congress, the archives of Congresswoman Patsy Takemoto Mink, right? So so part of it is a sort of disciplinary shaping, right? But also that I grew up with some of these stories. Chen Wensheng, right, was a household name for my family and for many other Taiwanese communities because he was of their generation, right? So so many people within those Taiwanese American communities knew him and loved him and identified with and were horrified by what happened to him, you know? So in each chapter, I look at how that specific case reveals particular dynamics of Taiwanese student migration. So chapter 3 looks at the case of Huang Qiming, who, unlike the majority of Taiwanese students during that time, went into area studies, right? So he was studying education in Taiwan under the Japanese colonial period. And this was true of a lot of the slightly earlier generation of Taiwanese student migrants of that time who were born towards the end of Japanese colonial rule, right? So they had that multilingual capacity. They could read and speak Japanese and Chinese, you know, and then they came in. So they were kind of primed to be able to function in Asian studies. But what really interested me about that is that Huang Qiming at University of Wisconsin, Madison, he was embedded in all of these activist circles and networks that I write about that were happening in Madison. But he was also the research assistant for Douglas Mendel, who was a political scientist who wrote one of the only, you know, full-length studies of Taiwanese politics, political formation in the U.S. called The Politics of Formosan Nationalism. But what was really interesting to me when I dug into the archive is how much of Huang Qiming is in Mendel's book, right? Because Mendel himself, he spoke Japanese, but not Chinese, right? So he really relied on Taiwanese students to do his research and translation for him. And Huang Qiming, he was also kind of a character. Like, he wasn't totally trusted by even his friends who had known him for a long time and his fellow students. He seemed to make a lot of bad decisions, right? So even when he was in prison in Taiwan, he wrote letters, you know, writing down the names of, you know, different people that he had associated with, you know, so there was speculation that maybe he was a spy or a double agent, right? But then he also met with a very tragic end, which is that he died in a car accident. He kept trying to come back to the U.S. after he was imprisoned, was not able to. And then he ultimately died in a suspicious car accident in the late 1970s that a lot of people assumed to be the work of the KMT, right? Because they had done other kinds of murders in this way, right? Suspicious car accidents. But that car accident happened after he dropped Douglas Mendel off at a speaking engagement at a university in Taiwan, right? So I was really interested in him as this sort of like shadow figure in that history of area studies as written by largely white men many of whom were diplomats, right, who had participated in those violent Cold War relationships between the U.S. and other countries that they were in. So that chapter is a slice of that history. And then the chapter on Chen Yixi, similarly, I mean, one of my disciplinary backgrounds is I'm a geographer, so I'm always paying attention to the specific regional context, the local context, you know, how we can understand the different scales of relationships that are happening in any given place. So chapter 4 focuses a lot on the East-West Center in Hawaii, and Tandy, you may be interested in it because it's a sort of quintessential institution of soft power, right? So it's established in 1959, in the same year as U.S. statehood for Hawaii, right? Lyndon Johnson is there wearing a lei, breaking ground, and it is its explicit purpose and setting is to present Hawaii as this like multicultural melting pot, right, that shows that capitalism and democracy yield the conditions, right, that the rest of the world should follow, right? And then it recruited students from places all around the world, but only places that were, you know, U.S. allies, right? So only students from Republic of China, not China, during this time period. And so a lot of students who went there received a quite different education from what was intended, right? Oh, and specifically they were recruiting students from Asia and the Pacific Islands, right? Because of Hawaii's location and positioning. So the Chen Yuxi case comes out of that context. And again, I was interested in this idea of students who are educated in something quite different than what was intended, right? And so you see these different layers of internationalist activism that come out of his case, right? From liberal to more radical left, right? And that comes directly out of the history of Hawaii, right? The sort of centrist, liberal, Asian American-led Democratic Party to the more radical worker, communist, you know, sugar plantation kind of organizing that also was coming out of Hawaii at the time, right? And all these factions came together to try to support Chen Yuxi after he participated in a couple protests against the war in Vietnam and may have read some communist literature in the East-West Center Library, right? And so there was another Taiwanese student there who was working as an informer, right, as a spy in the library who was keeping track of who was reading what, right? So that chapter traces in a lot of detail all the different groups that got involved in this and also how activists in Japan became involved also, right? And for activists in Japan, their understanding of the case was because Chen Yuxi was extradited from Japan to Taiwan. He was extradited from Japan to Taiwan, right? So Japanese activist critique was of Japan's mistreatment of its former colonials, right? And of Chinese, Taiwanese and Koreans. So each chapter kind of just unfolds all of these different sets of relationships and dynamics that I want to show that Taiwanese student migrants were also part of. And yeah. And then the Taiwan chapter has its own set of like totally interesting dynamics that also have to do with US arms export. I'll pause there and see if we want to move on to something else or keep going.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to, hard to address a question when we've condensed three chapters into it. also, just because of the breadth of different interventions and possibilities that come out of these three chapters, I think, like you mentioned at the beginning of your response, offer some really excellent opportunities for scholars to extend this work, right? And so, unfortunately, we're almost at time of our conversation, but before we go, I thought maybe we could kind of pick up on that theme, which is, you know, you have this great opening for future scholars to really take seriously Taiwan in Asian American studies. And I guess, where are you kind of going from here?
Yeah. First, about that opening, I'm really excited about what's coming next from other scholars, especially scholars, I would say, who are like half a generation or a generation younger than me. You know, I teach a class at the Claremont Colleges called Cold War Taiwanese America, and I'm so excited about what generations that came of age after martial law, what's possible for them. And also, there's just so much, you know, back and forth, global connections that are possible now that weren't from my generation, you know, so, and intellectually and politically, I think that's really exciting. And we're already seeing some of this scholarship starting to come out. So very excited about that. And happy to have, you know, opened the door in some ways, right, out of this very limited English language scholarship that had been available. For me, I'm pivoting a little bit to think less centrally about human beings, because human beings are so complicated. Not that other things aren't complicated, but you know, I already started working on a project while I was in the midst of this book about histories of gardens and plant migration as they are implicated in imperialism, colonialism, racism, and so on. But also, you know, just to think about the life of plants, you know, and these life worlds that are beyond the kinds of things that humans often get, many humans often get stuck on, you know, spending all their time and energy on. So part of that was looking at the history of camellias at Descanso Gardens. And most of that, the basis of that world-renowned camellia garden came from forced sales of camellias from Japanese American flower growers before they were interned, right? So I've been working with Descanso Gardens too, and family members, right, from those two families to think about how to present that history, how to think about that history, what we can learn from that history. And then I'm also working on some creative nonfiction writing about my, again about my family history, but in a more creative nonfiction way, about generations of my family that worked in northeastern Taiwan, in Yilan and Luodong, and in the mountains up there, up in the cypress forests during the Japanese colonial period. So I'm thinking about those trees, right? And about family history, relationships to land, and so on, but also how so many of those trees and plants migrated like human beings from, you know, Asia to the United States and still live in these colonial gardens, you know? So it's very broad, but, you know, broadly, plants, migration, colonialism, life worlds beyond the human.
That sounds so interesting. Also, just because, you know, I haven't been in I haven't had many opportunities to be in conversation with geographers. So to see mm-hmm. how you're interpreting these concepts and spaces particularly are really fascinating. So thank you so much again, Wendy, for sharing this hour with us and for being in conversation with Tandy and I about your book, Island X. I know that there's so many wonderful opportunities and ideas that are coming out of this text. And I really hope that people who are interested, not just in, say, Taiwan and Taiwanese American studies, but broadly Asian American studies, give this book a chance. So thank you, Wendy.
Thank you so much, Wendy, to both of you. It's been a pleasure.